The sun was heading toward the horizon by the time I made it to the somersault, my mind whirling with images of an army of 6-inch-high ninjas swarming a flailing Simon.
Tony! Tony! There you are, sweetie!
The voice drove the visions of warrior sugarplum fairies out of my head. I turned to see Frankie walking toward me. He was still out of the obvious drag, but not even a blind man would call his outfit conservative.
Hiya, Frankie.
He glanced at the door to the bar.
Ooh, are we having an early evening tipple?
No, I'm having an early evening steak and beer.
Wonderful. Ooh, I'm feeling a bit peckish myself. Lead on, my good man.
Frankie, I'm pretty tired right now, and I...
Not to worry, honey. I mean, all you need is a restful nosh.
He closed his hand on my shoulder and steered me toward the door. Tommy nodded at me as I passed through the door. The somersault boasted a moderate crowd for the hour, but there were a couple of empty booths. With Frankie in tow, I took the booth farthest from the door. Frankie slid into the seat facing me and plucked one of the menus out of its holder with a thumb and forefinger. Tommy appeared, put a couple of water glasses onto the table, and then took a second look at who we were.
Evening, Mr. Mandlin. That you, Frankie? Where's the dress?
In my past, Tommy, I have decided to show my masculine side and pursue alternate social avenues.
I saw the look Tommy gave Frankie's outfit and agreed. It placed the word masculine into a whole new territory. I desperately wanted things to move on.
I'll have a sirloin, Tommy. Medium, with a baked potato and asparagus. Bring me a beer to begin. Whatever's on draft and non-light.
Frankie looked at the menu as if he was deciding the fate of the world.
I will have the porterhouse. Rare. With a side of risotto. Saffron infused, of course. Draft beer, please.
Tommy dashed the order off onto his pad and headed into the kitchen. Frankie sat there looking at me with this silly smile on his face. I could only take it so long.
What?
He grinned wider.
It is so cool being your partner.
Partner? Frankie, don't say things like that, especially here and especially out loud.
But we're working a case together. I helped on the stakeout.
That doesn't make us partners, Frankie. Sometimes people help me, sometimes they don't. But I don't have a partner. I work alone, and you know that.
Frankie looked stricken.
But the stakeout, the police, Monahan.
To the police, Frankie, I'm little more than a sometimes useful irritation. You know how some unions will punish the new guy because he's working too hard? You know, embarrassing them?
He nodded slowly.
Well, my relationship with the police is something like that. I've solved a few cases they think I shouldn't have, and to make matters worse, I insisted on taking credit. This is how it is. They find me too useful to ignore, but not one of them would cross the street to stop me from being mugged.
Not even Monahan?
Sometimes I'm not so sure even then.
Well, it is good to help.
He reached out and patted the back of my hand. Tommy stood there holding our drinks. Tommy dropped Frankie's into place and then slid mine over to me. A folded note was under the glass. Frankie had his nose buried in his suds, so he didn't notice me palming the note. I slid it onto my lap as I picked up my beer with the other hand. As I sipped, I opened the note on my lap. It read, Schultz, in Tommy's handwriting. I looked around without turning my head. No reason to be obvious, but Tommy was warning me. I saw the reason why. There was old Schultz at the end of the bar, looking my way.
Frankie, we're going to have a visitor. This guy is old school. Real old school. I need you to play it way down, and I mean straighter than Gary Cooper.
Are you serious?
As a triple bypass.
His eyes widened.
I think he's coming over. Ooh, look at the size of those two.
With Schultz on the way over, I figured hiding behind my beer was a non-starter. I turned and saw the two slabs of beef flanking the old man. The one on the left was one I recognized from Schultz's office. I nodded in greeting.
Schultz.
He didn't nod back. Neither did he smile. He just stood there, measuring me as if he still wasn't sure if I bit or I was pettable. Frankie was completely ignored along with the rest of the crowd. All of that became background to the unanswered questions between the number two crime boss in the city and me.
Word gets around, Mandolin. I hear you's putting the herd on the guy what off driver's girls. I also hear you, him, and Lucchesi have a deal in the works. If me and my boys can help, I want a taste.
All I did was nod. I had no idea what to say, but my brain was whirling with questions on how to get rid of the idea I was a Lucchesi associate and still survive. Schultz took it as agreement. This time he nodded in one jerk of his head.
Let Lucchesi know that Schultz has got his back.
And that was that. The old man turned on a heel and stalked out of the place with his twin steers in tow.
Whew.
Oh, you can say that again. Who was that dangerous old man?
Nobody you want to get to know.
I downed most of my drink in one long pull. Frankie started to signal for refills.
Don't you want something stronger than beer?
Oh, what in the hell is that?
Frankie's eyes showed whites all around as he pointed at the pixie standing in the center of the table. The little figure gave me an expression of disgust that mirrored the one earlier at Union Square and then crossed his arms.
Do you want to get some answers, or do you and your oversized friend want to act like rubes?
Frankie's eyes did not go down in size. He just shifted them towards me.
Tony?
It's a pixie, Frankie. One of the little people you read about in fairy tales.
The pixie glanced up at Frankie and winked.
How's it hanging, sport?
Well, I never.
Oh, I'll bet you have.
Instead of another wink, Frankie got a leer.
Oh, Tony!
The pixie sat onto the tabletop, his legs crossed under him.
Aye. Look, you biggins are after the same vampire that has plagued me and mine for centuries. You need help, and we want revenge, right? So, how's about we put our heads together over a couple of stiff ones and we get on with the job?
Tony!
Slap him or something, will you?
He's real, Frankie. As real as that old man and as real as Simon.
I signaled for Tommy, caught his eye, and held up two fingers. I looked at the pixie.
Can everyone else here see you?
He beamed at us smugly.
Nope, just you two. How about that shot?
Your steaks are almost done. You want another beer?
Yeah, and a shot.
Scotch, single malt.
A shot of what?
How about a 25-year-old Macallan?
You want one too?
No, thank you.
Thanks, Tommy. Right. It's established that only Frankie and I can see you. What's the deal? You said that you could find me, and you did. Can you find Simon as easily?
It's not quite that simple. Let me have a drink and I'll explain.
The drinks arrived. Frankie immediately buried his nose into his, and I watched the pixie handle the shot glass. It was nearly as big as he was, but he simply picked it up and drank as if it was the normal way of doing things. He put the glass down and wiped his mouth on the back of a sleeve. Half the scotch was gone.
Ah, I needed that.
The steaks arrived, and we dug in. Whatever the little fellow was doing to keep himself unnoticed, it worked. Tommy made no mention of the third member of our party. Frankie attacked his porterhouse like a starving man. It was somewhat disconcerting watching almost 2 pounds of beef disappear as if it was an hors d'oeuvre.
So,
I know. Questions need answers. What do you know about the world of fairy? How about another?
He looked mournfully at the empty glass. The shot glass's rim came up to the pixie's hips.
Sure, why not?
I signaled for Tommy.
As for fairies, nothing outside of what I know from storybooks and movies.
Books and movies. You humans don't overtax your brains much, do you? Allow me to clear up what is obviously a very muddy picture. Fairy is its own world, and that world is divided into two distinct and very antagonistic regions. The Seely Court and the Unseely Court. Some divide the courts into seasons, summer and winter. Seely is another way of saying blessed or holy. A more accurate interpretation would be silly or beneficial. The Sealy will sometimes seek help from humans, and if offended, will warn the clumsy human. We will return human kindness with the same, and even offer a favour or two. We will, however, avenge insults, and a few of the Sealy can be prone to tricks or mischief.
He looked at me. Frankie was mopping up juices with a roll.
Do you recall Puck in A Midsummer Night's Dream?
Sure.
Puck was, if you recall, a hobgoblin. Your movies would portray my cousins as creatures of nightmare. I'll have you know that Puck is real, and one of the most famous hobgoblins ever. They're a respected part of the Sealy Court, even though they're most well known by their love of pranks and practical jokes, usually played upon humans. They never take the joke too far, mind you, and just as with most of the court, they can be very kind and generous.
Like you, the pixie, downing some of the second shot of single malt, missed my cynicism.
Exactly. Now, as I was saying, some of the more common fairies of the Sealy Court are the hobgoblins' cousins. The brownie, ferrishin, selkies, leprechauns, and of course, pixies.
What about the other court? Is Simon part of that?
Oh, thank Titania, no. That side is bad enough as it is. The Unseelie Court consists of fairies inclined to be malicious. Some would be considered downright evil. Unlike my kind, the Unseelie need no offence to trigger an attack. They have what they call the Wild Hunt. Now that your eyes and ears are open, if you ever hear hounds baying, run. As a group, the Unseelie, led by Queen Mab, will come upon their chosen victim and carry them away.
My heavens, this is real?
The pixie nodded.
Just like my court, the Unseelie cannot be fitted within a set box, but if given a choice, they will usually harm rather than help, and they will do so with enjoyment. Their preferred victim is almost always human. Bogies, boggles, boggers, abbey lubbers, and buttery spirits, not to mention succubi, satyrs, and banshee. There is also the Lenan Shi, from whose kind came Mab, queen of the Unseelie.
Is that all?
That's not even close. That's just an overview. I haven't even mentioned the various kins and the shapeshifters. Then there's the rules and assorted oaths. No, I haven't even started.
Ooh. He staggered, catching himself by the edge of the shot glass.
The pixie's potted.
Nope, just a bit drunk, thank you very much.
Lovely. Just when we were getting somewhere with this ridiculous case.
I'll have you know I'm nowhere near think as you drunk I am.
Right. Time to go. Huh? Frankie rose with me, a scowl beginning to form on his broad face.
All right. Take it easy, guys. I was just messing with you. We do that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Part of that mischievous thing you mentioned?
Yeah. I can be as drunk or sober as I like. The booze is just a fringe benefit.
About Simon,
Yes, that. Tracking down the vampire. You said it wasn't that simple. How hard is it? I want this guy out of the picture.
You and me both, big fella. Vampires aren't part of the court, but they aren't human either.
I thought they started out as people, and then they were turned into vampires.
Nah, that's just Hollywood. Vampires are separate from humanity, just as fairy are, but they aren't of either. They come from somewhere else.
And?
I don't know. No one does. It's like knowing a creature's true name. If you know the origin of something, you have a certain amount of power where it's concerned.
Name. That reminds me, I don't know yours. I can't just keep calling you the Pixie.
Call me Willet. It's not my real name, but it'll do.
All right, Willet. So how do we find and deal with this vampire? Can you be of any help at all, or are you just bumming a drink?
Tony, take it easy on the little guy. He's giving us information.
Nothing I can use. Or have you noticed that every time I bring up Simon, he's changed the subject?
Oh, yeah. Now that you mention it...
Willet looked like a little boy with his hand caught in the cookie jar. He lowered his chin and traced circles onto the tabletop with his finger.
Well, it's not all that easy to say. There's rules, you see.
So break them.
It's not that easy.
What will they do? Kill you?
Huh. If only. There's worse things than death.
Mm-hmm. Right. Clichés aren't an answer. His eyes locked onto mine.
It's not a cliché, believe me.
What would happen?
Imagine yourself being locked away for an eternity in a small cell with Rosie O'Donnell with a bad case of PMS.
Oh, my Dear Lord.
Damn right. And that's a light sentence. If I'm to help, I have to follow the rules. And where vampires are concerned, there's zero tolerance for breaking them.
So how would they know? No one's watching.
Just because you can't see doesn't mean the sky's empty. Your eyes may have been opened, but they haven't opened all the way. They'll know.
Perhaps it was my ingrained talent for finding stuff, but inspiration began tunneling its way into the empty cavern of my brain. Something Willett had said about favors and fairies. How about if I do something to make it possible for you to talk within the rules?
Oh?
Favor for favor. How about it? There's formal language like that in a contract, right? All right. How about this? I will provide you and your immediate family a bottle of scotch, quality and brand of my choosing, each month for the next year in return for the information I need in order to track down and kill the vampire known as Simon. Is that formal enough for you?
It lacks some of the these and those, but it'll do.
Good. Now, can you talk, or is there more formality to go through? Willett stood and bowed deeply from the waist.
I and mine accept thine offer, and by the accord do so pledge to fulfill to the letter the terms of our agreement. Be it so recorded. Ah, that's better. Now we can talk. I told you about fairies. What do you know about wizards?
The same as fairies or elves or any other storybook dweller. Practically nothing. I spent my life living and working in what I considered reality.
And in San Francisco, no less.
I suppose you think wizards are just the stuff of legend, right? Old men in robes and long hair, carrying fancy walking sticks full of eldritch power, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Gandalf was never real. Neither is Dumbledore. But wizards do exist, and they wield real power. I propose we enlist one for our side. There's a guy back east, but he has his own problems. No, we need one closer to home.
Find a wizard. In the city, There must be hundreds, thousands. I mean, just look at the ads.
I don't think the yellow pages is the answer, Frankie.
There's that guy in Chicago. But the PI is right. Most real wizards don't advertise through normal channels because they don't typically deal with normal people. Their customers, well, let's just say their customers don't often use public transport.
What? They fly on broomsticks, huh?
No. Mostly, they use the sewer system.
Ew.
Okay, so with no wizard, how do we find and deal with the vampire?
Well, unlike you humans, vampires don't stink. In fact, they don't have much of a scent at all.
You're acting like that's good news, Willett. Tell me why.
Because all we have to do is look for the hole.
Excuse me, the hole?
To my people, the air is filled with odors. We see it, like some animals do, only better. Like a map, a scent map. Nothing leaves a hole in the scent map like a vampire. All we have to do is seek out each empty spot and see who's there. One of those should be your Simon.
I don't see smells, Willett. How do I find these holes?
Ah, our agreement is with my people, remember? We'll look for you. One of those holes should be the vampire we want.
One of them? How many of those things are out there?
Ah, a few hundred. Give or take a couple thousand.
No. Sorry, Tony, but this Black Beauty did not sign up to battle thousands of vampires. Good luck, and let me know when it's over.
Easy, big fella. Vamps aren't pack animals. They don't even socialize with each other. In fact, they're highly territorial. If anything, you might get a thank you card for removing the competition.
Well, that's a relief.
Okay, how do we do this?
Bring a bottle to Union Square before dawn. We don't want any biggins walking off with it. Then, wait for our report. When we find your vampire, we'll let you know.
He nodded as if that settled the deal. I held my hand to Willett, and he took hold of a fingertip. That bottle will be waiting for you as agreed.
Good man.
And he vanished. My apartment still had an unsecured window, so I grabbed a comforter and a pillow. The old couch in my office would have to serve as a bed, at least for tonight. I remember opening, shutting, and locking my office door. I don't remember my head hitting the pillow. I'm not in!
Mandolin!
Coming!
Monahan pushed through the door just as I opened it.
Rorsch escaped. Again.
Hey, Pat, good to see you. How are the kids? Thanks, I'm doing just fine. Been a while.
Cut the crap, Mandolin. This is serious. That man has a serious grudge against you, and he's not going to make the same mistake twice. I tried calling your apartment, and then I figured you'd be here. Lucky guess.
What the hell are you doing, Tony? I'm told you met with Antonio Lucchesi? Consorting with mobsters? Do you have any idea how that plays down at headquarters? I'm doing what I can to get someone down there to pay attention to the damage Rorsch can do, and you do this?
The general consensus is that you're now some sort of wise guy.
I shook my head and sat down on the couch. Monahan stood in front of me, his hands on his hips. I could see the muscles of his jaw twitching.
Something on your mind, Pat?
Look, Tony.
He threw up his hands, turning away. I took pity on him.
I'm no wise guy.
I didn't say you were. What I said was that the general consensus is that you are some sort of wise guy. I never said I agreed with it. What the hell are you doing messing around with Lucchesi?
Monahan was so pitiful, I decided to tell him the truth. Starting with the twin slabs of beef at the diner, I walked him through the whole sordid affair, finishing with the promise I got from both Lucchesi and Driver to supply intelligence as to Simon's whereabouts. I left off the amount of my fee.
Old man Schultz is spreading the word that you're Lucchesi's main man, and the decision makers in the department are buying it.
On what evidence?
On the evidence that you are considered an irritant! Gods, Tony! You know bureaucrats, they don't need a good reason to screw someone. They just need a reason, and you've given them one complete with gold plating.
And how am I supposed to get to this serial killer, Pat? Trust in the goodwill of the police department to do something? You and I both know that this case is just too weird for them to do anything. Those bureaucrats of yours are too concerned about their own reputations. They will bury it and be glad, and you know it.
Monahan kept quiet. He knew me well enough to grant some space.
Did they send you here to arrest me?
No, but neither are they going to do anything to save you. Seems Rorsch's escape may have some additional weirdness attached to it.
You mean someone in the department let him escape?
That's my guess.
I told Monahan about what Schultz said at the somersault. I added to that the number of unsuccessful tries I made at attempting to dissuade the old gangster of his opinion.
That old man was senile during Prohibition. Your real concern is Rorsch. And with the department being told in no uncertain terms to back off, you have a real problem.
Yeah, no life insurance salesman will return my calls.
Instead of blowing his top, Monahan collapsed into the chair across from my desk.
Bad jokes aren't gonna get you out of this one, Tony. Rorsch is gonna kill you and my bosses are gonna let him get away with it. Tell me this, Tony. Who in the hell did you piss off? All of a sudden, I'm getting not-so-subtle messages that if I don't drop this so-called vampire killer case, I'll be fortunate to get a job dusting the evidence locker.
How do you tell someone that the guy with a mat on about you is a real vampire, and it looks like this real vampire has real juice with the police brass? I decided to stay out of the booby hatch.
I don't know what you're talking about, Pat. Rorsch has a good reason to hate me, I agree with that. But I don't think even internal affairs would do what you claim is going on.
Don't piss on me and tell me it's raining, Mandolin. Something is going on and I'm gonna get to the bottom of it.
No matter who it inconveniences.
Monahan expressed his displeasure with my sense of humor in very colorful terms. He even brought up my vampire theory, using the possibility that my involvement might be threatening someone's re-election hopes. I had to play dumb, mostly because I was. Simon could be the one influencing the higher-ups in the department, but so far, that was just a guess. It did, however, make a lot of sense and give me a possible line for investigation. I finally agreed to watch my back and lay low, just to keep Monahan quiet. Figuring Rorsch would try for another ambush, I left my office's building through the freight entrance in the alley. I came out of the alley onto Grant and hiked the couple of blocks to Union Square. Today, the square was empty of festival. No booths, no balloons, and due to the fairly clammy overcast conditions, almost no people. I checked out the place where I'd left Willett's booze. It was gone. I could only hope that he'd gotten to it before the winos woke up. I wandered, lost in thought. Eventually, I ended up at the farmer's market tucked behind the art college where Market and Hyde intersect. As soon as I left the bus, my nose was assaulted by an assortment of mouth-watering aromas. Indian, Italian, Mexican, and Middle Eastern. Each regional scent tiptoed across my taste buds with unrelenting intensity. I had no idea I was that hungry. A glance at my watch showed why. I'd been in a fog for nearly 3 hours. A roast chicken and a couple of anchor steams took the edge off and helped me to think a little more clearly. It was a sure bet that Simon was behind both Rorsch's escape and the police department's decision to shut down Monahan's investigation. No other theory came close to making as much sense. The question now consisted of not only finding the vampire, but how to circumvent his added layer of police protection. I had to face it. Right now, Simon had a lot more guns on his side than I had on mine. That had to change. It was time to make a phone call.
How can I help you, Mr. Mandolin?
I told him about Monahan's visit and my suspicion about Simon and the police. Lucchesi didn't seem at all surprised by the news.
I see. It seems, Mr. Mandolin, that I am now in a position to play a small part in our agreement. I have one question, though.
Go ahead.
I have to assume that you have not called Randall Driver with a similar request. Is my assumption correct?
It is. My problem involves corruption at the top. If anyone can help me with that, it's you.
Very astute, Mr. Mandolin. Your assumption is correct. A good businessman not only understands his market, he also understands his competition. As with any governmental organization, the police department has those in its administration who cannot live within their means, as do those in the higher governmental offices. In exchange for a bit of latitude where I and my organization are concerned, I augment a few select tax-free accounts.
Okay, TMI. How can you help me?
I have a contact in the mayor's office. Through this individual, I have some access to the police commissioner. A select word and your friend will be free to act on our behalf. But doing so will make him no friends. The commissioner is a vindictive woman.
I hadn't thought of that. There was no more vindictive animal than a politician or bureaucrat forced to do the right thing. Then what can we do? I can't endanger Pat. He's got a family.
Allow me to work in my own way, Mr. Mandolin. Your friend will be unmolested by anyone. Goodbye for now.
If I'd been on the receiving end of that implied threat, my entire wardrobe would have needed changing. The city had more than its share of farmers' markets. This one wasn't one of the largest, but being easily accessible for locals, it attracted good-sized regular crowds, and the prices were not set for the tourist trade, which meant more food for the buck. I passed by the stall selling assorted honey products and saw something out of the corner of my eye. A very familiar mustache. Rorsch was in the market. Whether this was accident or design was anybody's guess. I ducked into the space between the mushroom farmer and the potter as casually as I could. At least this time I'd seen Rorsch before he saw me. Unfortunately, I wasn't armed, just like the last meeting. I eased along the back side of the booths, trying to keep Rorsch in sight. That strategy didn't work out so well as I came up against a dead end and had to backtrack. Rorsch was waiting for me next to the mushroom farmer. He had his .45 hidden in the folds of his coat.
Hey, Tony. Good to see you. I didn't know you shopped in this part of town.
His eyes didn't promise me a long future. I kept my hands visible and eased sideways towards the pottery booth. The last thing I wanted to have happen was Rorsch opening up and putting holes in some innocent shopper. I put on my best phony smile. Hey, yourself, Walt. How's the kids? That new job working out for you? I saw his eyes narrow first, and then his gun hand twitched. Mandolin, why are your survival instincts so low? Rorsch's face went through a series of expressions, and then he gave me another smile. I didn't like it.
Nice try, Mandolin. Let's go, shall we?
As I stepped into the flow of the crowd, Rorsch moved up alongside of me. I could feel the barrel of his gun as it pushed into my right kidney.
I've been looking forward to this for a long time, Mandolin. You've been asking for it, and now that the department's seeing things my way...
You really think you'll get your badge back?
The way they feel about you, Mandolin. Hell, I might even get a promotion.
He jabbed me with the gun.
Quit stalling.
I looked over the crowd around us, hoping to spot the blue uniform of a patrol officer. Most of them were low enough on the chain of command that I still had a chance of getting an even break. As was typical, not one was around to be seen.
When we get to the exit, turn right. You try to run, and I shoot.
I'd run out of smartass replies. With my brain still running in high gear and getting nowhere, I left the market and turned right. Rorsch kept the gun buried in my kidney. On the sidewalk, the crowd thinned out.
Turn right on Hyde. The car's parked there. You get to ride in the trunk, Mandolin.
I could see why Rorsch chose Hyde for his parking spot. Two large buildings, neither of which had a main entrance facing the street. The sidewalk was almost empty compared to Market. To put it bluntly, I was screwed.
You ever been to the landfill, Mandolin? You'll like it there. Lots of things to remind you of yourself. Lots of scum and trash.
I have never wanted so badly to punch a guy right in the face. It's amazing how well the business end of a semi-auto can keep the body behaving in a civil manner, even in the presence of extreme provocation.
Come on, Mandolin, where's that famous sense of humor? Stop here.
We stood next to a silver late model sedan, the typical car of a metro detective. I was slightly surprised. I would have assumed an expensive import for Rorsch. Rorsch pulled out a small car remote and held it up before him. The trunk unlatched.
Get in.
Rorsch.
The gun hit the pavement. I turned to see Frankie standing there holding a limp Rorsch and a bear hug. Note to self, confine greeting with Frankie to nods and fist bumps. No hugging.
Hi, lover. Ooh, what are you two up to?
I glanced back at the open trunk.
Nothing that couldn't be set aside.
Turning back to Frankie, I motioned to Rorsch.
I think I have a place where you can stash that heap.
Monahan sounded grudgingly pleased when I called him about Rorsch. He was less happy about a memo he got regarding the serial killer case. It seems someone at the top wanted it reopened, in spite of the objections from those on the ladder rung just below. For some reason, Pat blamed me for his superior's dilemma. I decided to play it safe and not point out that this outcome was what he wanted. Frankie was unbearably smug about having saved my life. I had to threaten him with what seemed to me to be justifiable homicide to get him to dial it back to a reasonable level. A phone call to my landlady told me my apartment was capable of supporting life again. I headed back to the apartment to get some sleep. My phone woke me. It was Monahan. He had nothing to report except that being forced to reopen the case on Simon only had the powers that be giving lip service to the investigation. Oh, they were very polite and also so very sorry every time a file got misplaced, but it was obvious that they were dragging their feet. Monahan was getting fed intelligence with the bureaucratic equivalent of an eyedropper. I listened to him vent about the idiocy of the top brass until he finally ran down.
Anyway, I digress.
Is Rorsch talking?
Only about how you're gonna get yours. Seems your death is his favorite subject these days.
Any mention of Simon?
I had no doubt what the answer would be.
None.
See? Sometimes I hate being precognistic.
Thanks, Pat.
Boy, you humans sure like to complicate things, don't you?
I turned and saw Willett standing on my other bedside table.
We found your vampire. Oh, by the way, thanks for the scotch.
You found Simon?
Yep. Easy peasy pudding and pie. Finding one vampire's no problem when you've got a few hundred noses doing the sniffing.
I got out of bed. Great! What's the address?
Address?
Yeah, the place where you found Simon. I pulled on my pants.
What's an address?
A sick feeling rose up inside of me as I realized he wasn't pulling my leg. The street name and the building number. You're serious? You don't know what an address is?
Oh, that, of course. I know about addresses.
I pulled on my shirt.
Willett, the address.
Oh, yeah. You see, it's like this. I'm not the one who found where the vampire lives. That was one of my cousins, and she doesn't know anything about addresses. As far as she's concerned, one place is pretty much the same as another.
Then how do I get anything out of this arrangement? How do I track down this salt-sucking vampire?
Easy, big guy. There's a way to work this out. Tell you what, pour me a shot, and we'll discuss this.
I headed over to the coffee maker.
Yeah, I'll pour you a shot of coffee. You don't get anything stronger until you earn it.
Hey, that ain't kosher. We had a deal.
Yes, we did, didn't we? And it seems to me that part of that deal was you and yours do something more than just lead me down the path of frustration in exchange for a monthly bottle of scotch. Telling me that an unnamed cousin of yours found the vampire and that she has no way of getting me there isn't fulfilling your part of it. What's the penalty for one of your people reneging on a contract, Willett?
You wouldn't do that, would you, big fella? You wouldn't call the deal broken.
I had no idea how to do that, but I wasn't about to let him know.
Tell you what, you get me to Simon's place, and I'll add another bottle to the deal.
Watching a war of fear and greed pass across a pixie's face is an event, let me tell you. Willett bit his lip, turning his head from right to left, his whole countenance an agony of indecision.
Fine, if you're more afraid of the vampire than you are of the fairy court...
Deal! Boy, have you got a deal. You know, for one of the big folk, you're pretty shrewd, not to mention a real hard ass.
I have my moments. All right, Willett, how do we do this? Your people know where Simon is. I need to find out where that is so I can make sure his little feeding frenzy is stopped. This is where you say something useful.
I poured a cup of wake-up juice.
All right, then. According to the rules of the...
Okay, I'll get a hold of my cousin and figure out some way of getting you directions. But you better finish that vampire or we're all done for. They don't take too well to having their nests spoiled out. Jeez, you sure know how to play the bully.
The coffee was beginning to do its work. I felt more or less human and decided to cut the pixie some slack.
You can count on it. As soon as you get me what I need, I'll do my part.
Instead of the second bottle of booze, my part meant making a couple of phone calls. No way was I going up against Simon without some serious backup. Willett sprouted a tiny pair of translucent wings and zipped out of my apartment, passing underneath the front door like some kind of medieval dragonfly. Shaking my head at the world I'd gotten dropped into, I picked up the phone and called Lucchesi.
Mr. Mandolin, my sources tell me that certain individuals in the commissioner's office are very unhappy with you.
What are you talking about, Lucchesi?
It appears that our target was very deeply involved in this city's governmental circles, possibly to the point of, shall we say, supernatural levels. These individuals did not enjoy having their power usurped. If I did not know better, I would say that the level of frustration is nearly homicidal.
So, nothing's changed, huh?
Quite droll, Mr. Mandolin, and quite brave. Nearly any other man in your position would be making plans for travel right about now. Now, I suppose you called because you either have a question or a statement to make.
Yeah, one of those.
And which one is it?
The statement. A source of mine has discovered where Simon's place is. I'm in the process of getting the address.
Ah, very good, Mr. Mandolin. You continue to uphold your reputation. My own network has failed to produce results. I do assume correctly that Randall Driver and I will be invited to this event once an address is established.
You and the Fifth Army, if I can get them. Remember, this guy is serious medicine, and I just got lucky last time.
We will be prepared, Mr. Mandolin.
He hung up. I then called Driver and had to leave a message. That only left Monahan and Frankie. If I left either of them out of the hunt, there would be assorted hells to pay. On Pat's side, I'd find myself up on charges at the very least. On Frankie's, ever-increasing levels of unending bitchiness. Guaranteed. In the end, I decided to let them in on the kill. I just hoped we weren't the ones doing the dying. Willett showed up around noon, and this time he brought company. My apartment was awash in pixies of all shapes and sizes. Some sat on the kitchen counter, some occupied the shelves. Several fluttered in the air on those translucent dragonfly wings. Willett!
Hey, big fella. How do you like my family? They wanted to see the big'un with all the booze.
He moved in closer.
You haven't got any hidden away, do you? You see, I sort of promised.
Look! I've got an apartment full of pixies and still no answers on where I can find Simon, Willett. I need you to point out your cousin to me so that I can get that information you said you'd get me.
Oh, that.
Yes, that. Which one's your cousin?
They all are, except for my brothers and sisters. We have large families.
All right, which one is the cousin that knows where I can find the vampire?
He pointed toward a pile of his relatives collected against one of my couch pillows.
Okay, and which set of arms and legs is she?
That one, I think.
You think? You mean you're not sure which one of your cousins told you?
Well, it's kind of hard to tell. I mean, they're triplets and all.
Triplets?
Common in fairy folk families.
I walked over to my couch. The pixie girls were laying in almost a weave pattern.
Ladies? Willett says one of you knows where my vampire is hiding. I'd be very grateful if you'd help me.
They flew up and hovered at eye level about a foot from my face. Now that I had a chance to focus on them, I could see that Willett had been right. They were triplets. The only apparent difference was the color of scarf each wore. One was pink, one lime green, and one a bright sapphire blue.
Bambi.
I'm Sandy.
I'm Tammy.
Tammy added a lascivious wink for good measure.
Nice to meet you, ladies. I'm Tony. What I really need to know, ladies, is where I can find the vampire named Simon.
Tammy darted behind her sisters, who held on to each other. I tried to ease their fear. The last thing I needed was my only source of info to vanish with a case of the frights.
I know he scares you. Your cousin Willett told me all about it. I told Willett that I would take care of him, and I keep my word.
Tammy peeked out from behind her sisters.
You do?
What had Simon done to these people?
I do.
I really meant it. Whether 6 inches or 6 foot, a client was a client.
I know where the vampire is.
Good, good. Can you tell me?
Sure. It's staying in the big house right over there.
She pointed off to my left. I guessed it was roughly northwest from my apartment. That narrowed it down to several thousand buildings if I stayed on this side of the Golden Gate.
Thanks, Bambi. Can you tell me a little bit more about the house?
Like what? It's a house with a vampire in it.
Like its color, maybe? What shape it is and the other houses around it?
She screwed up her face and thought. Tammy and Sandy looked at me like I was spouting gibberish.
What shape? It's a house. A big'un's house.
See, what did I tell you? They don't know from addresses, big fella. They just know places.
I could show you, maybe, if you like.
Our plan came down to Willett riding on my shoulder while the triplets acted as guides. This with the full understanding that I allowed them to scatter once we were a block or so from Simon's place, as long as I knew which house was his. We had just finished hammering out the details. Every pixie in my apartment vanished, including Willett.
Tony! You in there, dearie?
Frankie had been shopping again. He walked into my place decked out in a plus-size version of Humphrey Bogart's Sam Spade outfit. Behind him came a blonde. I mean, a blonde. This one had long hair pulled back into a ponytail and a pair of primary attractions worth a second and a third look. She stood a couple of inches taller than me. A glance down said that was without wearing heels. Unlike Frankie, she wasn't wearing a 1930s private eye costume. This one wore very serviceable pants over a pair of expensive trainers with a worn leather jacket over the turtleneck that helped show off her attractions. Strapped to the pants was one of those knives called an Outback Bowie. More of a short sword than a knife at nearly 16 inches. She noticed my appraisal and nodded. Not a greeting, just an acknowledgement of my presence. This was a very dangerous woman.
Frankie, who is this? And why are you dressed like a noir private eye?
He had the good grace to appear at least a little abashed.
Tony, this is Miss Edge. Mr. Driver sent some men over to see me, and I don't know how he found out where I live, but these two very serious men said I had to come here and to bring Miss Edge with me.
And the outfit?
This old thing? I thought it fit the mood of the times.
Bringing his attention back to me, he reached into his coat and pulled out a super soaker squirt gun.
Tony, why do I have to carry this thing? Oh, Lord have mercy, it smells like salad dressing.
That smell is vinegar, Frankie. As far as the vampire is concerned, you're packing serious heat.
What, no holy water?
I'll explain later. Miss Edge, what is your part in this little adventure?
Mr. Driver and Mr. Lucchesi thought you could use some backup, Mr. Mandolin.
What I could use is an army.
That would attract attention. And you don't strike me as a stupid man.
Looks can be deceiving.
I pulled my trench coat out of the closet and stuffed a couple of spray bottles into the pockets. Each bottle was loaded with white vinegar. Edge raised an eyebrow at me as I did so, but kept her opinion to herself.
Okay, team, let's go kill us a vampire.
When we hit the sidewalk, Willett and his cousins came zipping in.
Hey, Mr. M?
Out of the corner of my eye, I could see that Frankie was in seven kinds of hell holding his tongue, but the big guy managed. Brandy's directions sent us into the heart of Pacific Heights. Leave it to Simon to set up shop in one of the oldest, most expensive neighborhoods in the city. We were at the corner of Fillmore and Jackson when Bambi pointed down Jackson.
Stop! It's there! In the tall house with the points on its roof.
The only house in sight that fit that description was the Victorian on the other side of Steiner across from the park. Knowing Simon, it fit. Such a location would be right in character.
Gotta go. Good luck, Biggin.
All right. My intel says that the vampire is in that Vicky right across Steiner. Any ideas on how to do this?
Those old houses usually have front, back, and side doors. Three doors, three of us.
I thought back to the blinding speed Simon had displayed. Three of us separated, as far as I was concerned, equaled three victims. Edge had shown remarkable restraint so far. I hoped my luck would hold.
No, I know this guy. He has unique resources. If we separate, he'll just pick us off one by one.
Any chance that the backyard has cover?
Only one way to find out.
Crossing Steiner, I could see the tops of trees peeking out from behind the Victorian. A couple of doors north on Steiner, I could see the mouth of an alley. Not surprising, since a lot of these old buildings had old carriage houses in the back that now served as garages.
Let's go down the alley. We should be able to get into the backyard through there.
We turned off Steiner into the alley. Keeping the roof line of Simon's house in mind, I found the proper garage. This one, as typical of the many historic homes in San Francisco, did not have a modern garage door in place of the original carriage house doors. In retrospect, I think it had more to do with Simon's arrogance than anything else. He'd been a predator for so long, he'd never imagined himself becoming the prey. Edge used the spine of her oversized knife to pry up the latch holding the doors shut. The inside of the garage looked like Simon hadn't cleaned there since the time of the 1906 earthquake. Cobwebs lined the ceiling and the rafters. Crouching in the center of the garage was an old two-door coupe. It looked to be vintage.
Ooh, ooh.
1930 Bentley 8-liter coupe. Ooh, nice ride. Very well kept. This vampire of yours has taste, at least.
I looked around the garage. Other than the dust, cobwebs, and the car, I saw nothing else of any interest. The door leading out of the garage and to the backyard was set into the left-hand side of the rear wall. Outside the door was the backyard, and it looked as if Simon paid about as much attention to his yard maintenance as he did to his garage. The yard was thick with undergrowth. A brick path wound through the yard toward the house.
Ooh, Tony, this...
Shut up! This man took out five of the best. Do you want to be the sixth?
Frankie shut up, but I could see his lips mouth the word bitch as we continued along the path. The overgrowth thinned a few feet from the back porch.
Hold up.
The porch was enclosed with large multi-paned windows bracketing the home's back door. Through it, I could see into the kitchen and another room beyond. There was no sign of Simon, but the pixies had been adamant that he was here. I pulled out my technically illegal police-issue lockpick.
I'll check the door.
Edge and Frankie nodded. Edge looked to be as unruffled as ever. Frankie, on the other hand, was ready to scream. The fact that he hadn't was even more impressive than Edge's calm. I tried the door. It was already unlocked. We slipped into Simon's house, Frankie and I on one side of the door and Edge on the other.
Still no sign of Simon.
I pulled out my spray bottle of vinegar. Following my lead, Frankie hefted his squirt gun. Edge pulled her knife.
We go through one room at a time, just like you see in those cop shows, but no yelling out. Clear. Okay, Frankie?
Okay, Tony.
Got it.
The kitchen was large, typical of most upper-level Victorians. Connecting the kitchen to what looked like a parlor was a wide, heavy-framed archway. The walls were covered in antique embossed paper set between dark wooden dividers. Inset bookshelves of the same dark wood held an impressive collection of volumes, and at least two wingback chairs with reading tables could be seen through the archway. Edge and I sidled along the kitchen walls toward the parlor as Frankie came around the island. The parlor was as empty as the kitchen.
Let's head upstairs.
We went up the main stair, three abreast, as silently as possible. But I was sure that wasn't enough. My heart had to be pounding loud enough to be heard in the attic.
I'll check this bedroom. Frankie, take the bathroom. Cover us, Edge.
On it.
Empty.
Ditto. Let's check the third floor.
It was beginning to look like the pixies had been wrong. I worked my way up the stairs to the third floor. Frankie and Edge followed me.
Tony, I don't think anybody lives here.
It looks like your intel was wrong. This place is empty.
Yeah, looks like. Let's go. What's this?
I bent down and picked up a small black glass bottle.
Trebuchet. Guys, wait a...
Oh my God!
Simon smiled up at me from the second floor landing. His face showed no signs of damage.
Ah, there you are, Mr. Madeline. And you brought guests. How nice. I was wondering what I was going to do for lunch. I've been considering our last encounter, Mr. Madeline, running the sequence of events over and over in my mind. There's no possible way you should have been able to survive, much less defeat me. The poor fools who attempted to waylay me after I exited your building confirmed my analysis. They were easily twice the warrior you could ever be.
I backed away from the head of the staircase, twisting open the cap on my spray bottle as I moved.
Seems to me there was a way. I did it.
Simon's smile dimmed.
Yes, you did it. And now it is my turn.
He rushed forward in that same blinding speed he'd shown earlier, batting the spray bottle out of my hand. He grabbed both of my wrists in a crushing grip.
Oh, by the way, I also brought guests.
Three more vampires surged out of the stairwell, their faces already changed into the feeding form. Two of them were hit by a stream of liquid and reeled back.
What?
Simon's momentary distraction allowed me to put a knee into his groin. He collapsed onto the floor.
Who's your daddy?
Frankie continued to wield his squirt gun, moving the stream back and forth between the two thrashing vampires.
Spike a bottom! Spike a bottom! Oh, come on, baby, come on. There's more of that where this came from.
Edge ducked a blow that should have broken her neck, turned, and planted a heel into her attacker's solar plexus. The vampire flew across the hallway and bounced off the paneling. Pivoting on her heel, Edge drew her knife and slammed it into the vampire's neck, nearly severing it from the body. Blood spurted.
Bastard!
Simon struggled to get to his feet. I didn't give him another chance. I put my toe where my knee had gone. I collected my spray bottle and took aim.
That will be sufficient, Mr. Mandolin. I would prefer him to be alive, thank you.
I turned to see Randall Driver coming up the stairwell. Behind him came Lucchesi, and then Philip and Smithers.
Philip, Smithers, shackles, please.
Simon's hands and feet were bound with heavy-duty zip ties. The two bodyguards carried Simon back down the stairs. Lucchesi glanced down at the three corpses littering the hallway.
Your team is very thorough, Mr. Mandolin. Miss Edge, your services are no longer required here. There will be something additional placed into your account as a token of my appreciation.
Edge nodded, finished cleaning her knife, and left.
Where did you find her?
Mr. Mandolin, please allow me some secrets. Mr. Jackson, I see my gift to you proved efficacious.
Frankie patted the squirt gun.
I know what you're thinking. Did I fire six shots or only...
Frankie!
What are you going to do with Simon?
That is for Randall Driver to decide, Mr. Mandolin. It was his daughters the vampire killed. Now, you will also find a more tangible form of my appreciation waiting for you back at your office. You may wish to use it to find a more secure place to live. The decision, of course, is yours to make.
Willett and his cousins joined Frankie and me as we walked back down Jackson. The rain had slacked off into mist again. Willett perched on my shoulder. His cousins flittered around me.
Hey, big fella, you did it!
Yeah, Willett, we did it.
Now that the adrenaline was leaving my system, I began to feel an all-consuming weariness. Frankie, on the other hand, looked like he was ready to move on to round two.
I think I'm going to head home and sleep for a week.
Right, right. I tell you what, me and the girls will give you some space and check back later.
Yeah, thanks, Willett. See you later.
Frankie and I parted ways near Hyde Street.
Goodbye, Tony.
I don't really remember my head hitting the pillow. The next morning, I woke up to find two of San Francisco's finest were at the door. They needed me to accompany them downtown for a bit of interrogation. They used the term questioning, but we all knew what the reality was. It seemed the people behind Rorsch had no sense of humor and even less patience with uppity PIs. I was ushered into an undecorated room with a steel table and a couple of steel chairs, all three pieces of furniture bolted to the concrete floor. I sat in one chair and listened to a detective ask the same series of questions over and over again. I asked the same question back. Was I under arrest? Over and over again. Apparently, I was just an assignment, and a boring one at that. Eventually, another cop came in and told me I was free to go. I didn't ask why. I didn't want to push my luck. It had to be some more pressure from on high. Kind of a my guy is bigger than your guy pissing contest with politicians involved. Monahan met me outside the room.
They finally brought you in, eh, Mandolin?
Thanks for the help, Pat.
Wasn't me. I didn't even know you were here until I got a phone call from the deputy mayor's office. Looks like you upset the wrong people this time. Someone in the commissioner's office has moved into a full-blown vendetta against you. Scuttlebutt has it that it's the commissioner herself.
Yeah, someone told me that earlier.
You should have taken it to heart. By the way, I still haven't gotten any leads in that serial killer case. Have you had any luck?
Some.
I took out one of my cards and jotted the address of Simon's house down onto the back.
Check out this place. One of my sources noticed someone who looked like the killer going into there.
And when were you going to tell me this?
As soon as I found you, which is now.
I stopped by my office and found the thick envelope Lucchesi had alluded to. I think Driver may have added his own bit to it. That suggestion Lucchesi made about moving was starting to make some sense. On the way back home, I noticed some things about the street traffic I hadn't before. Perhaps it was because I'd finished a case and no longer had it on my mind. Or perhaps it was something more. Willett had mentioned something about my eyes being open. If that was it, the city was crawling with life other than human. I'm Tony Mandolin, and I handle the weird ones. A Tony Mandolin Mystery 1, A Slight Case of Death, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2011 by Robert Lee Beers. Published by arrangement with the author. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2017 The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and/or duplication is prohibited. Starring Bradley Smith as Tony Mandolin, Elliot Dash as Frankie, Patrick Bussink as Monahan, Matthew Keenan as Willett, and Richard Rowan as Simon. With Andy Clements, Jason B. McIntosh, Michael Glenn, Gregory Lennington, Don Ursula, Jacob Yeh, Tia Shearer, Kimberly Gilbert, Nora Ashrati, Andy Brownstein, Terrence Aselford, Chris Stinson, David Jordan, Zeke Alton, James Konacek, Yasmin Toison, Scott McCormick, Rose Elizabeth Supan, Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, Matthew Pauly, and Michael John Casey. Directed by Bradley Foster Smith. Book adapted for graphic audio by Eric Messner. Produced by Richard Rowan, Dwayne Beeman, and Matt Webb. Executive producer, Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Casey Green. If you enjoyed A Tony Mandolin Mystery 1, A Slight Case of Death, read the Kindle edition. Visit www.amazon.com. And be sure to look for A Mick Oberon Job, Warlock Holmes, Necropolis, and the upcoming Tony Mandolin Mystery 2, One Last Quiche. All available in graphic audio at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our action-pumped titles as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio.
On your feet, Watson! The game is afoot in the wolf at our door!
Sherlock Holmes is an unparalleled genius.
Why does a detective inspector of Scotland Yard ask the help of, well, you?
I am a sort of consulting detective.
What is a consulting detective? I've never heard of such a thing.
It means that when certain individuals encounter a crime that they cannot solve, they call upon my powers of observation.
Warlock Holmes is an idiot.
And they pay you for your help?
No.
Ah, then you are credited with solving the crimes, which helps build your reputation for private practice.
No.
Then Holmes, why are we going?
The only thing he has really got going for him are the might of 1,000 demons.
Roche, Roche, justice comes upon the wicked. The finder knows. He that beheld the work beheld him that did the deed.
And his stalwart companion.
I too believe I have discovered a fact that will be pivotal to the solution of this case.
And what's that?
That my new friend John is really good at this sort of thing.
Thankfully, Dr. Watson is always there to aid him through the treacherous shoals of Victorian propriety.
I don't care about such things, Watson.
Well, you ought to, or you'll be caught.
Caught at what?
Nothing.
And save him from a gruesome death every now and again.
Oh, dear. It's even worse than I expected.
What do we do?
That all depends upon you, I think. Now, understand, Watson. That thing is looking for a human sacrifice. There's only one thing for it. Good luck!
A magical detective, not afraid to get his hands dirty, and possibly sacrifice a friend or two along the way. G.S. Denning's Warlock Holmes. Same as the old Holmes, only this one is a little hell-bent. Now available in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can select from over 900 titles and 60 series in either CD or high-quality download formats. If you would like to listen to an entire series, you can conveniently purchase the whole sets on CD or USB flash drive from graphicaudio.net. At graphicaudio.net, you can now earn loyalty rewards points, redeemable toward future online purchases. You can also get full mobile downloads directly to your phone or tablet with our new Graphic Audio Access app, available on all Android and Apple devices, so you can listen on the go, anytime, anywhere. Call 1-800-670-5220 or visit www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our email newsletter, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter.